Well, I went to see 2001 Space Odyssey. This wasn't the first time, but in the largest theater in Times Square at the time. This is late 70s, by the way. And it's a theater where Ben-Hur and some of these other movies had premiered. And so the lights go down, the credits start, and all of a sudden, all around me, people are lighting up joints, opening bottles of wine, passing stuff around. And so we all want to get, well, we, the audience wanted to get as stoned as possible. So at the end, when Dave is sitting in his chair and the lights are rushing past him, that we're experiencing the same thing he is. And it was successful. People were very generous with their products, though. So. To The Deduction, a podcast from the Tax Foundation, your guide to the complex world of tax and economics. My name is Scott Hodge. I'm president of the Tax Foundation, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, we're going to look at the taxation of cannabis or marijuana. So I guess today's episode is a potcast, not a podcast. All right. Well, no more puns. And there will be no more I didn't inhale moments either. Anyway, this is a serious topic, even though it lends itself to lots of fun. But I'm delighted to be joined by Ulrich Boesen, senior policy analyst here at the Tax Foundation. And I got to be honest with you, no one has been providing more thought leadership on the taxation of marijuana than Ulrich. So welcome, Ulrich. Great to have you with me.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, let me say at the outset that I had no idea how complicated this issue was until I read the policy paper you wrote last year called A Roadmap to Recreational Marijuana Taxation. You know, I grew up ideologically within the libertarian movement starting in the early 1980s. And at that time, decriminalizing drugs, marijuana in particular, was a big issue because libertarians sort of see this as the use of marijuana as a victimless crime. And we would often argue that in addition to sort of taking recreational use out of the shadows, that governments could tax it. So it would be a win-win. But when I read your paper, I realized it's a whole lot more complicated than we used to sell it as. And so I'm delighted to have you walk us through all of these very complex issues today. And maybe I guess we can break up the conversation into three parts, kind of a broad overview of the landscape, the challenges then with taxing marijuana relative to other products, and we can go into greater detail on that. And then wrap up with the federal issues, which really add some complexity and challenges to this debate and some things I frankly had never thought about. If Washington's going to get involved, they better do it right based on some of the things that I've been reading that you've been publishing. So maybe we could just start with that landscape issue and just kind of give us a scope. You know, how many states are now taxing marijuana and how are they doing it? What's the marketplace? Whole variety of things. I'll let you kick us off.
Sure. I think this is a very timely episode because just over the last 48 hours, we've had two more states join the party, so to speak. So currently we have 17 states that have legalized and are taxing recreational marijuana. They do it in various ways. So the most common way that states tax this is based on price. This is probably related to the simplicity of that type of taxation. So marijuana market is incredibly diverse. You have pre-rolled joints, you have flower material, but then you also have brownies and vapor products and seltzer waters. So just taxing the price is maybe the simplest way to go about it. And I think that's why most states have done it. If you've listened to our podcast from last week, you may know that we would disagree with this. The excise tax is there to internalize the externality. And that's related to the quantity you consume. And a few states have looked into this. So Alaska, for instance, taxes recreational marijuana based on weight. So up there, it's the amount that you consume that's taxed, not the price that you pay for it. And just the other day, New York joined and passed legislation to legalize and tax recreational marijuana, and they're taxing it based on THC. So they're the first state to implement a potency-based tax. that will account for the strength of the cannabis that you consume. So we are seeing some development in this area and states looking more to better ways to capture the externality and using better proxies for harm. But most states still just basically tax based on price. Now, the marketplace differs very much from state to state. So in some states, you have a large percentage of people that use marijuana, and in other states, you have a much smaller percentage. But the general market is estimated to be quite huge. The projections say that the market could be worth upwards of $30 billion by 2023. So it's understandable that lawmakers are enticed to get into this and to tax that economic activity. I mean, this is something that's been going on for decades in the illicit market. And now there's a trend to decriminalize. And with that comes the opportunity to tax. And with a market size that big, that's obviously enticing to a lot of state lawmakers, especially given the pandemic that we've seen over the last year, where there's been some uncertainty about state revenues.
But after reading your pieces, I understand that it's a lot more complicated. You know, there's the danger of overtaxing. There's the issue of trying to use the taxes for general revenues as opposed to very specific things. And you've talked in the past how important it is to try to focus the excise tax on the externalities. And yet it's very clear that many governments and politicians are looking at this as a cash cow rather than something to address externalities. Maybe if you could walk through some of these trade-offs and the trade-offs between the economics behind the different ways in which these products are taxed have different implications in terms of, you know, the market overall.
Right. So I like to think about it in terms of what is the intention of legalization. And I think that sort of informs how a state's going to go about it. So some states have obviously pushed for this kind of legalization in order to raise new revenue. If you do that, you risk coming at it with the intention of taxing it as much as you can at the highest possible rates. Now, the cannabis market is not a regular marketplace. First of all, there's a well-established illicit market that your new legal dispensaries will have to compete against. And it's incredibly diverse, as I mentioned before. So you have to be very careful when you're a lawmaker that the level of taxation you impose on your legal new operators does not make it impossible for them to compete with illicit operators. So the total tax burden is key here, right? Because the intention should be decriminalization. You want to turn something that used to be illegal, that you used to be convicted for, into a legal activity. In order to do that, you need to foster a legal industry in the legal marketplace. That can't happen if you overtax it. So the tax burden is crucial, obviously, along with cost of regulation and the like. But taxes play an important role here.
Now, so what you're saying is you could actually create a prohibition-like atmosphere just simply by overtaxing.
Absolutely. And that's what we saw in California in the beginning, right? You had legalization actually increase the market size of the illicit market because the burdens that were put on the legal operators made it impossible for them to compete. So the illicit market grew faster than the legal market. You have to be very careful with this. And when you design tax policy, you also have to think about how this market looks and operates. Because it's federally prohibited, everything must happen within state from seed to sale. That means day one of legalization, you don't have any supply because it must be grown. This is a plant that must be planted, cultivated, dried, manufactured, and sold. So supply is going to be really low in the beginning. Now, if you tax based on price and you have high demand, low supply, that price is going to be really high. And a price-based tax will make that even worse. Then as time goes by, as price falls, when supply increases, that tax is going to be much lower. So one way to circumvent that is to not tax based on price and tax based on quantity. And you have a stable revenue raiser that's always taxing or always bringing in the same amount of tax revenue per ounce sold or whatever your base is going to be, instead of relying on price, which is going to be fluctuating quite heavily because of the way this market operates.
Fascinating. So that plays into, I guess, some of the issues you mentioned in one of your pieces about trying to discourage consumption of kids. And you kind of, here again, is the trade-off. If you try to overprice something, then you just create conditions for black markets and you can kind of mess up the entire market. Or, as you mentioned, because of the diversity of products, that also raises real challenges in how you tax it. As opposed to, I think you were telling me once, tobacco or alcohol, where there are really a limited number of products. And so taxing them is a whole lot simpler. With this, as you mentioned, with the real expansion of the number of products, that really does change the way in which you have to think about taxation.
Right. And I think that's a really good example. If we think about the tobacco market, you have cigarettes, cigars, you have loose tobacco, and you have a few other products. It's very easy to assign a tax rate to each product. That is not a possibility when it comes to cannabis products because there are so many of them. So you would have hundreds and hundreds of tax rates, which would make this system too complex. Instead, what you have to do is find out a good common denominator, so to speak, to tax. For your smokable products, such as joints or flower that people purchase and smoke, you can either tax that based on THC content or quantity, so weight of the plant. But when we're talking chocolate bars, brownies, concentrates, seltzer waters, and all the other ones, the only thing they share in common is the THC content. So for those products, it basically only makes sense to tax them based on THC if the intention is to capture the externality. Because the issue is, if you tax based on price, and I'm selling you a chocolate bar with high quality chocolate that's very expensive, and someone else comes in and selling really cheap chocolate, the tax rate would be different if I tax based on price. But that has nothing to do with the externality of the cannabis that I put into the product, which is the tax is there to internalize. The tax, and see if this makes sense, but the tax, we have a tax that's supposed to capture the economic activity and the difference in what the consumer spends. That's called general sales tax. That is there to raise revenue in a more progressive way, saying people who spend more should pay more in taxes. The excise tax is just there to internalize the externalities. That's only related to how much cannabis is in the product, not related to the price the consumer pays. That's why we're advocating for a quantity-based tax that doesn't fluctuate with price.
Well, that's one of the things you pointed out in your paper was how much more potent marijuana is today as compared to, you know, 15 years ago. And I got to be honest with you, the smell is a lot more potent today than it used to be. I live in Washington, D.C., where my neighborhood is surrounded by pot smoke. And it's really strong compared to when I was a kid, which smelled like burning lawn clippings. And I'm guessing that over time, as growers have become more sophisticated, that the potency has changed. And that has to play a role in this as well.
So I think that's the right answer. That after this was legalized, I think Colorado is the first state to do that in 2014. The ability of growers to develop their skills in a legal operating market has just exploded. And they can now produce plants that are a lot more potent than they used to be able to do. We don't know for certain that smoking a more potent plant affects the consumer differently. Because there are all sorts of theories about how you inhale the smoke and the like, and how that affects you. So it's not a one-to-one, just because it's a little bit stronger in terms of THC content, you get more intoxicated. There's no questioning that the product that is sold today is a lot more potent than what used to be sold. And a potency tax accounts for that. I mean, that is one of the reasons it makes sense to do it that way. If the intoxication is what you're trying to capture in your tax, basing it on the potency of the plant makes perfect sense. It's sort of similar to how we tax very strong alcohol at different rates that not so strong alcohol.
Oh, I see.
So it's built into how we tax already at the federal level. For alcohol.
What is the externality here? I was thinking about this, I guess, maybe as in libertarian terms of, you know, this is a victimless crime, so to speak, and perhaps different than tobacco or even alcohol. Well, maybe, I don't know. Is it more analogous to alcohol where you have recreational use as opposed to tobacco where, you know, you can have, or other externalities that come from other activities?
I think that's a point of contention. I think it's more similar to alcohol. I think the biggest issue with this is intoxication. Someone eating a brownie, not knowing how high they got and getting behind the wheel of a car. No. That's something you want to avoid, obviously. You're going to have to spend some money as a state to make sure that you capture those who do that. And this could be relatively expensive because state troopers and state police don't necessarily have the skill set to recognize if someone has smoked pot or cannabis or if someone has eaten a THC-containing brownie. I mean, we don't have a test like we do for alcohol. So this is not very easy to do, and it could cost some money, but it's probably one of those spending priorities that are really important for states to legalize to make sure that the people out in the front line who have to enforce this know how to do it and can do it in an appropriate way. And this is one of the main externalities. I think you would also want to consider some youth prevention. All the states have legalized for people who are 21 and above. You want to keep this out of the hands of teenagers because it does affect the developing brain, just like alcohol and tobacco does. So there are certain things that are identified that states are likely to going to be spending money on. And these are the externalities that we're discussing when we're talking about cannabis consumption.
Which states are doing it right, so to speak, relative to others? And, you know, you did talk about the size of the marketplace, you know, billions of dollars, obviously very enticing. How much are states raising? Which ones are maybe raising too much relative to what they should be, or misusing it by dedicating it to general revenues as opposed to specific things?
So the states that have developed the best functioning markets right now are also the states that have been doing it for the longest time. I think time is a crucial ingredient here. It allows lawmakers to understand how to work the system, how to regulate it in a way that works. And it allows time for entrepreneurs to build and build their brands, build their stores, so consumers get to know what the legal market has to offer. And it also allows time for people who may have been using through the illicit market for so many years to make the switch. So time is crucial. In Colorado and Washington State have been doing this for 7 years almost. Mm-hmm. And they've been relatively successful in terms of limiting illicit market activity, which I think is the main point that they should be measured on. This whole thing was about decriminalization. So if you can limit the illicit market, you've done well. It's also resulted in meaningful revenue for these states. Colorado last year raised over $300 million through their excise tax. Washington State, I think, is about $400 million. So there's meaningful revenue, but there's also a lot of costs involved. You got to establish and operate a whole new regulatory framework. You got to do testing. As I said, there's problems with driving under the influence. You're probably going to want to do some youth prevention campaigns. There might even be some drug treatment that you need to spend money on. So there's lots of cost that states will need to spend this excise tax revenue on. Unfortunately, most states also do dedicate some of this revenue either to general fund or to pet projects, like it could be highway projects or environmental projects or even new schools. Which are not really related to how many people consume cannabis, and shouldn't be related to how many people consume cannabis. But this is this thing we see with almost all excise taxes. If there's a popular product with low elasticity, which most addictive products have, like alcohol, tobacco, which means you can raise the price and people won't stop using it necessarily, lawmakers tend to overindulge and increase that excise tax rate just a little too much to get that extra revenue out, because it would be nice to have a little bit more in the general fund, or it would be nice to have a little bit more to spend on environmental projects. So these issues we do see in this marketplace. And I think most states have done this, have overindulged and have an excise tax rate that is a little bit higher than what's warranted in terms of internalizing externalities. We are seeing that some of the newer states, mainly in the Northeast, that are legalizing, are coming in at lower rates. They also don't have the benefit of being a Washington state that's very big, or a Colorado state that's very big. If you're Massachusetts, you have to compete with the states next door. So you've got to make sure that you're competitive. So these states are coming in closer to 10% of the final price in terms of effective tax rates on their excise tax, where Washington State has an effective tax rate of 37% at retail. Colorado is at 22 or 23 effective rate. So they're significantly higher, but they have the benefit of not having borders close by to the majority of their residents.
So even though theoretically you're not supposed to carry these products over state lines, you still get some cross-border sales and competition from that.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a state that have legalized and your neighbors haven't legalized, you drive close to a border, you will see tons of cannabis retail stores right across the border. Because obviously residents are going to come in to purchase it legally in the neighboring state. They'll probably say that they're purchasing it and consuming it while they're in state. And I'm not going to question that. But I think it's likely that we are seeing some inflow into states that haven't legalized yet if they are bordering a state that have.
A little bit different than going playing slot machines over the border or doing the gambling. Hey, one of the issues that you point out is kind of a wrinkle in all of this is the issue of medical marijuana. You point out that should not be taxed, or at least in the same way. Talk about that a little bit. And you've got competing products. One is a for medical use, and then the other one's recreational. How do we think about that?
Yeah, and it's a complicated issue. My position is that medical marijuana shouldn't be taxed because we're trying to internalize externalities when we use an excise tax. And if your doctor says you're better off consuming medical marijuana, there is no externality, right? It's a positive. There is no negative externality, but at least there might be a positive externality. So there shouldn't be a tax applied. Now, some of these medical markets, if we're honest, are actually recreational markets. And there's a big question mark there. What do you do? And I think that won't be answered until the federal government deschedules, because that may change the landscape for medical marijuana nationwide, and especially in the states. You know, Oklahoma is a good example. It's a very big medical market. It is basically a recreational market. What happens there when the federal government decides to deschedule, if they do that? I think it's something that will maybe finally answer this question. But in theory, if something is taken for medical purpose, an excise tax has nothing, no application, no legitimacy, because that should be there to internalize an externality. The only reason to levy an excise tax on a medical product is as a revenue grab, which is not appropriate.
So that's what the so-called dispensaries are those the real, like, is it Massachusetts has dispensaries? Is that just a euphemism for a store, or is it more of a medical use?
They're called dispensaries, really, whether they're recreational or medical.
Oh, I see.
If you go into one, I mean, oftentimes they'll have a pharmacist there. I mean, in the medical markets, it is oftentimes regulated in ways that emulates how you would get other drugs. But you'll often see the list of ailments that qualify being so wide that anyone who wanted it could get a medical marijuana card. There'll be stuff like insomnia would qualify you to get medical marijuana, which I don't know if there's a test for insomnia, but I'm fairly certain you just tell your doctor, I have insomnia. He then writes a recommendation for medical marijuana, and there you go.
Right. But then you're up all night with the munchies. So then I don't know how you get any sleep. Oh, I was in Massachusetts. My wife has family there. And we were in Massachusetts when they sort of opened up the dispensaries at the same time that the governor decided to ban flavored vaping and cigarettes. So that didn't make any sense to me, but what do I know? Pivot over to the federal issues, because this is where things really get complicated, it seems to me. And you outline in a couple of papers, and one recently where there was a flawed federal bill that had come up. Let's walk through that. I guess you got how many issues? I guess the government has to delist this. You've got banking laws. You've got social justice issues. Holy cow. It doesn't get more complicated than that.
No, federal reform will really complicate the issue. So because of the way this has happened, state by state in siloed markets, federal intervention will almost certainly revolutionize the markets, right? These markets today in the states are set up to work in silos, which means, you know, all cultivators must be there, all distributors, all manufacturers, all retailers, and all consumers must be in state. If there's descheduling at the federal level, interstate competition is likely to be pretty prevalent, right? I've seen estimations that all the THC and cannabis that is needed to satisfy the U.S. market could be grown in Southern Oregon. So the question is, how many of the cultivators will survive around the country, and how many tax systems that are currently in place in states are ready for such an eventuality? So one example is in Alaska, for instance, where it's very expensive, obviously, to grow cannabis because it must all be done indoors. They levy their tax on cultivators, but in a world of interstate competition where all the retailers and distributors are not going to buy from local cultivators because it's much more expensive than buying from Oregon cultivators, that tax revenue might disappear altogether. And it's very unlikely that Alaskan cultivators would survive, given that they would have an additional excise tax, even if they export the product. Plus, it's already more expensive for them to grow it in Alaska. So those guys are unlikely to survive in a world of federal descheduling. And most states are not ready for that. Basically, they'll need time to readjust their regulatory framework and their tax framework if there is federal descheduling, mainly because of interstate competition. Now, there's also positives. You mentioned the banking issue. Federal descheduling opens the banking world for many of these businesses that can't currently access capital. There's also 280E, which is an interesting corner of federal tax code, which was implemented in the 80s as a response to a drug dealer that was able to deduct his business expenses after he was caught and put on trial for tax evasion. He was basically saying, well, I had expenses for my runners and phones and office supplies. He was able to deduct that. The federal government didn't think that was appropriate. They passed a law that said, if you're trafficking Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 drugs, you can't take these deductions. Obviously, even if you're a state legal dispensary or cultivator today, you're still trafficking Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 drugs, which means when you come to pay your federal income tax and you want to take your regular deductions, you can't do that. You only deduct cost of goods sold. That has the effect of increasing the effective tax rate on your income tax to sometimes above 100%, especially in the early years when you're spending most of your money investing into your business. That would disappear if descheduling were to happen at the federal level. That would be a massive help, especially to retailers, which have, you know, rent that they pay their employees, and all these other things that normally a business can deduct, but they can't deduct right now. So that would be a game changer for retailers, a very positive one. And then capital, obviously.
And the price might go down because of those costs, right?
I think interstate competition, 280E, and access to capital, it's almost certain the prices will come down significantly, which is another reason why price-based taxation is short. It's not a good long-term result.
Right.
Because obviously, if you're taxing 10% of retail price and the price drops by 50% after federal descheduling, your tax revenue is going to drop 50%. Now, if you were to tax the quantity, right, the ounce of cannabis sold in your state, you wouldn't see that drop. It would be a lot more stable that way.
What about federal taxation, though? I mean, Uncle Sam is not going to do this out of the benevolence for the states, and they'll probably want to cut for themselves with some sort of a federal excise tax. How do you see that playing into both price, supply, revenues? Are they going to eat into or cannibalize state revenues? How's that all work?
Yeah, and this is where the variety of state taxation really presents a problem for the federal government, because basically, regardless of what they decide to do, they'll mess it up for one or two states. There's no question they're going to implement a federal excise tax. Repealing 280E for cannabis businesses is a net loss for the federal government. They're going to want to make that up through an excise tax.
Oh, I see.
So there's no question. They're going to do this. They're trying to figure out how to do this in the best way. The first proposal, which was on the MORE Act, was a 5% manufacturing tax. She has all the same issues of the state price-based taxes. It's not stable. Doesn't actually internalize the externalities. That was sort of a primitive, simple proposal. I think it's more likely they'll come up with a specific tax of some kind, maybe a weight-based tax, maybe a THC-based tax. That's how they do it for alcohol. That's how they do it for tobacco. There are multiple reasons. First, you can game a price-based tax. Right? There's transfer pricing issues. You can sell another product and gift cannabis products as part of a promotion. For instance, let's say a store says, if you buy two T-shirts, you get an ounce of cannabis for free. If you're taxing based on price, that can be gamed. You also don't want vertically integrated businesses that operate as cultivators, manufacturers, and retailers to artificially sell at low prices through the value chain to limit their tax liability. Is one of the issues they have with their only ad valorem tax in the tobacco world, which is the cigar tax. It's heavily undervalued when it enters the market to limit the tax liability. It's much more stable for them to tax based on quantity. So I expect that that will be the end result. They have to be extremely careful. As I said, some of these states levy very high effective rates, and coming in at a high level with a federal tax could make it so that a state market, when you add the state tax, would result in an effective rate that made it impossible for local dispensaries to compete with illicit operators. So they have to be extremely careful how much they add to the total tax burden from the federal side of things. But they'll also have costs. I'm sure the federal government is going to want to do its own testing. They're going to want to do research into the impact of long-term cannabis consumption.
FDA regulation.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be tons of things that the federal government will have expenses to do, and they're going to want to recover that. So there'll be costs. And there's also been talk from Senate leadership that they want to invest some of the revenue into the communities that have been hit hardest by the war on drugs. They're asking the federal excise tax not only to internalize the externalities from current consumption, but also the externalities associated with prohibition over the last many decades. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of spending that politicians and lawmakers want to do, and they're asking consumers of cannabis to pay for. There's probably a middle of the road solution that will allow legal operators to compete and yet raise enough funds to run these systems. But they have to be extremely careful that they don't overdo it and plunge what has been relatively successful in many states back into their starting point with a too big of an illicit market.
You know, I'm reminded you were talking about gaming the price, and there is a, for lack of a better word, a delivery service here in D.C. Where they will deliver $10 worth of chocolate chip cookies and give you a free bag of pot along with it. And of course, that's to get around some of the other rules here, but you can see how that might be an option. And people are clever, you know. And you know, when the obstacles get too complex, they find a way around them. So that's this has been fascinating. I think I walked into this thinking this was a simple issue, but it's tremendously more complicated than I think anybody might expect. Any last thoughts? If either a federal legislator or a state legislator came to you and said, what should we do? What are some basic principles or thoughts that they should keep in mind as they move forward?
I think the number one thing is intentions behind reform. So I want lawmakers that move on this issue to come at it from a place of decriminalization. I think that's going to inform regulatory burdens, that's going to inform tax burdens, and that's going to actually allow for a transfer of previously illicit activities into now legal activities that will limit the amount of people that have come in contact with law enforcement. But I think there's been a tendency to overpromise what this reform can do. In many ways, we're not legalizing cannabis. We're simply creating a licensed system for access of cannabis, right? It's not milk. It's not like we legalize and then you can go and buy it everywhere. If you want to sell cannabis, you're going to go through a process of getting a license. You're going to pay to get a license and you're going to have to follow all these rules and regulations for ingredients, who you can sell to. So it's not just legalize. It's creating a legal pathway to get access to cannabis. Because one of the things we've seen, many states decriminalized use many years ago. They haven't really been enforcing the ban on cannabis.
Yeah.
But now you legalize. Now you have legal source that operate in your state. And you have an expectation of tax revenue. You basically have a skin in the game if you're a local state government. Now you're going to want to enforce what you didn't previously enforce, which was illicit sales. So in some states, localities, legalization can result in more policing than before. So I think it's important that lawmakers understand this, right? If they have a projected tax revenue goal and they have spending they want to do tied to that money, they're going to make sure to get it. And the only way to get it is to make sure that the only sales that happen are legal sales. Mm-hmm. The people who may not have gone through the process of getting a license, of only selling to people above the age of 21, of getting all the right tests, they might continue to sell their products to the back of a van or from their bike or whatever, how they do it today. And they may not have had that much contact with law enforcement before because it was decriminalized. It was sort of a gray market where it was acceptable behavior. Now there's tax revenue tied to that. So local governments may spend more money policing this to make sure they get that tax revenue they have promised and were promised. So lawmakers have to be really careful about what they promise this kind of reform can do. It's not going to revolutionize tax revenue, and it's not legalizing in the way that many people think about it. It's still going to be heavily regulated. And I think that's just crucial that everyone understands this, because at the federal level, we might even see someone like the FDA get involved, right, to regulate the medical market.
Sure.
So what's medical today, which the FDA has not been involved in, versus what's medical 5 years from now when the FDA may be involved and may require all products with a medical claim to go through the pharmaceutical drug application process, which costs millions of dollars. So the medical market of today may not be the medical market of tomorrow. Federal legalization is not some nirvana where cannabis will be available to everyone. It'll be expensive to get into this business. There'll be tons of regulations to comply with. And tax revenues, although meaningful, is not going to revolutionize anything for state governments. I mean, they'll still have to raise taxes through all the regular means and just add a little bit to pay for running and operating the legal recreational marijuana market.
Well, thank you very much. I got a feeling this may be one of the biggest tax experiments or social experiments that we've ever had in this country outside of Prohibition and that experience. So this will be a fascinating time to watch. And thank you for providing so much thought leadership on this issue, because I know there are a lot of governments and legislators around the country that have been watching and reading your material and seeking your guidance on this, because it's critically important at this time. So thank you for joining me. Thanks for the fascinating discussion. I've had a great time listening and learning. And I want to thank all of you for tuning into The Deduction. And to be sure, we'll be back soon with another interesting dive into the world of tax policy. I'm Scott Hodge, president of the Tax Foundation. I look forward to talking to you with you again soon. So be safe and be well.
And that wraps up this episode of The Deduction. We'd love to hear what you think about this podcast. Please let us know at taxfoundation.org/podcast.